Welcome to another edition of Garden Talk. Hi, Larry Mueller here. You know, many times commercial growers can do things you and I can't do in our backyard gardens, but some of their techniques are very translatable, and we'll talk about those today with our guest, Claire Strader. She is a small-scale and organic produce educator with Dane County UW Extension and Fair Share CSA Coalition. She has lots of experience with both commercial and home gardens, and she'll share those that bit of information with us, and of course, answer your questions about organic vegetable gardening. So, what are some of your favorite organic gardening techniques? Are you thinking about going organic this year? What would you like to know? Give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at ideas@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page. Certainly love to hear from you. And Claire Strader, welcome. Great to have you with us.
Thanks. It's very good to be here.
Well, I'm really glad that you could come by and be with us today. What do you do as an organic produce specialist?
Well, I work with the organic vegetable producers in Wisconsin. Mostly, I work with the 50-plus growers that are part of the Fair Share CSA Coalition. All of those growers grow organic vegetables and sell them through CSA, which is where consumers sign up at the beginning of the year and then get a portion of that harvest from the farm throughout the growing season. And those growers are, when they're serving CSA, they really have to be at the top end of their game because of the wide variety of produce that is expected through those CSA shares. So they can come to me and say things that they would like to learn about, and then it's my job to bring in speakers and provide research to really give them what they need to stay at the top of their game.
Yeah, and it's can be difficult sometimes doing these things organically. Disease and insects, and there are all kinds of little problems that can develop out there that may sometimes make you wish you could use something other than organic on the crop.
I have to say, I'm not sure what the farmers would say about that, the organic farmers, but I can speak from my own personal experience. I was a professional organic vegetable grower for close to 18 years before I took this position. And as someone who only ever grew vegetables organically, it never crossed my mind really to think about what I could do in a conventional setting, just because I was never exposed to it. I think that the people now who are transitioning from conventional production techniques to organic techniques, there might be a little, just because they know so much more about how to grow vegetables conventionally, it might be a little bit harder transition. But I know a couple growers in particular who are making that transition right now, and I'm really interested to see how that goes for them.
Yeah, that must be kind of a fun job, isn't it?
Yeah, well, I do get to talk with a lot of growers and learn a lot about techniques that they're using on the farm, and think about that for my own vegetable garden. And also, you know, one of the really great things about my job is that I get to bring farmers together to learn from each other and also to help them learn from the extension specialists throughout the state. So one thing that's coming up on February 2nd and 3rd is the 2018 Organic Vegetable Production Conference, which is really for that pro-level farmer who wants to really dig in deep on specific topics specific to organic vegetable production and really talk with other professionals in the field, because there's so much synergy there. There's so much to learn from each other. And I get to be part of it, too.
I like the way you describe it. Dig in deep.
Yeah.
Perfect for a gardener.
Right.
Oh, my goodness. You know, Brooke on Facebook says she's finally taking the advice of many of her gardening of our Garden Talk guests to get a soil test. Is there just a basic soil test, or are there add-on testing options to consider for her raised beds? Is there some place in Madison that will do the test? I don't think there's a place in Madison, but there
Yeah, not that I know of. Brooke is a step ahead of me on taking that advice. I always had a soil test on the farm. I did that every year. But when I now that I just grow in my own home garden, I actually have my soil test where I've taken the samples sitting on the counter waiting to be sent in. And the way that I would go about that is to connect with your extension office locally to find out the best place to send that soil test. And then when you fill out the paperwork for the test, you can indicate on there specifically that it would be for vegetables. And you I'm sure that you can also say raised beds. I don't know that the people who do the analysis would do anything special because of the raised beds. But it's you can always mention that on the test report. And I think for right now, I would say a pretty straightforward test that gets you the organic matter and the three big ones. Micronutrients are also important for vegetables. And if you can find out that information from that test, what your levels are and what they should be, that's also helpful.
The UW has one soil testing location in Marshfield, and they can be sent there, but there are many private labs, including, I think there's one fairly close to Madison, if I'm not mistaken, and should be able to find, I'm certain that the Lisa Johnson here in Dane County will, and since Brooke is from Dane County, she's probably the person to call, or whoever the master gardener is answering the phone that day.
That's
will
right.
certainly have that information. And there's some nice PDF online, I know, of the procedures for doing it and so forth, how to take an appropriate test. Probably aren't going to be able to do it right now.
No.
Well, Pam in Kellogg, Minnesota has a question, I believe. Hi, Pam.
Good morning. I have done a lot of gardening over the years, and containers are real handy, and most of the time we fill them with potting soil. So to do it organically, and you want your things to really produce, I have done tomatoes and many other things, but they don't produce like they do in the soil. So how do you do it organically?
Okay.
Yeah, I think that is, whether you're doing it organically or conventionally, growing something in a container is always much more difficult in some ways than growing it directly in the soil. And part of that is because in a container, the roots are naturally bounded by the boundaries of that container. And when they're in the soil, they're able to range much more broadly and get access to the things that they need to grow. So in a container, having the biggest container that you can possibly manage would really be helpful. When you're choosing a soil mix to put in that container and you want to do it organically, it's good to make sure there's a fair bit of compost in that soil mix. Compost is a component of the soil, and organic matter is a component of the soil that will provide long-term fertility for the plant. Often conventional inputs are providing a quick boost to that fertility. And when you're switching to organic production, you're really thinking about the longer term fertility in that soil, and compost is a really great way to provide it. So choosing a high quality soil mix, a high quality potting soil is the first step. And then after that, you may need to add fertility, again, because that container is bounded and the roots don't have the ability to range beyond that container. And some organic inputs you could consider to boost the fertility while the plant is growing would be fish emulsion or kelp and seaweed. Those two things are pretty common on organic farms when farmers are growing in a container. So, for instance, they'll do that if they're growing tomatoes in a greenhouse for the long term. They'll put those roots typically in a container instead of directly in the soil, and then they'll use the fish emulsion and potassium, calcium.
I also understood years ago they used to have their gardens in old tires, and I've asked several people if any of that stuff would come off. Would that be anything that was not beneficial doing it in tires? Because I'm getting older, and I would like to not have to go down the hill to, if I had it right up here in the yard closer, and I did the tractor tires. Is there any research that says there might be something harmful coming off the tires?
I am not I don't have access to that research, so I can only go off of my own intuition, which would be that I would choose a different container. You can use 5-gallon buckets that you can get from the hardware store. And I know Larry and I were just talking before the show. He uses straw bales, so I was quizzing him so I could learn about his methods for that. So I think, you know, Larry could speak to that, and those would be two good alternatives, I think, to the tire.
Okay, thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks very much for calling. Appreciate your call. You mentioned fish emulsion, and I do have my lime tree indoor plant that's still has about 30 limes on it right now, but I just use fish emulsion, and that's all I use, along with the, you know, some with every watering.
Mm-hmm.
And limey's been at it for several years now.
What size container is the tree in?
It's about this big around.
Larry held his hands over his head there.
I'd say it's about like a 5-gallon bucket or a little bigger.
Wow, that's incredible. That's amazing.
Yeah, and it's quite a good producer for sure. Well, you can join in too, question or comment, as we talk with our guest today, Claire Strader, small-scale and organic produce educator with Dane County UW Extension and Fair Share CSA Coalition. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page. Questions about using organic methods to garden in your backyard? Or maybe you're somebody who's also thinking about, hey, I've got this property and I'm thinking of starting kind of a CSA-oriented type of farm operation, small scale. Hope you can join in with that as well. 1-800-642-1234. Chris on Facebook asks if you could talk about companion planting and plant repellent plants. And, you know, the one that always comes to people's mind, I think, marigolds, for example. Do they work in with your veggies?
Yeah, at the farm, I always planted marigolds in my tomato beds. Usually I would put a marigold plant in after every 10 or 15 plants. So, and I was planting them directly in the row with the tomatoes. But on the garden scale, you know, having some marigolds in and about the garden is a good idea. That's a fine idea. Another companion the idea with the marigolds is that they would repel some insects from the tomatoes. The main insect that is attacking tomatoes is the tomato hornworm, and some of you may have seen those. They can be these massive green worms with these two big and green antennas off the top there, and they kind of are the size of your finger, your thumb. And I really like to see when they are parasitized by the Trichogramma wasps. And sometimes you'll see that in your garden, and it's that big worm, and it may be still green if it's been recently parasitized, or it may even be brown and dead if the parasites have started to hatch out. And the way you can tell that it's been parasitized is that it'll have all these white cone-shaped things poking up off of the back of the worm. They're pretty small, and when those Trichogramma wasps hatch out, those are little like trash can lid that opens up at the top of that comb where the wasp has escaped from it. And at that point, the tomato hornworm should be brown and dead, because all those little wasps have sucked nutrients out of that worm in order to grow and hatch. And the way you can get some of those Trichogramma wasps in your garden are not necessarily what I would call companion planting, but just planting beneficial habitat in the garden. So things like umbels, or Apiaceae is the name of that family, those plants are very attractive to things like those trichogramma wasps. And what they do is provide nectar so that those adults can live while they're looking for a tomato hornworm or some other pest in your garden to parasitize.
And how do you spell that plant? Are those...
The Apiaceae?
Yeah.
Oh, that's a great question. I'm a terrible speller. Umbels was the umbelliferae was the name of it.
Umbelliferae.
Yeah. So there's dill and carrots are an umbel. Those are, there's also the Queen Anne's lace is an umbel.
Another one.
Yeah, I had a lot of those self-seed in my garden the other year, and I was lucky enough to find one of those parasitized tomato hornworms. It totally made my day when I saw that.
We'll get to Christine in Woodstock in just a second, but a reminder again, join in with your own questions at 800-642-1234. I'm Larry Mueller, Jill Nadeau, our producer for Garden Talk, here on the Ideas Network. Taking a look at organic vegetable gardening with our guest today, Claire Strader of the Dane County UW Extension and Fair Share CSA Coalition. She's had many, many years of experience, and both on her own as a grower herself, but also with educating commercial and home gardeners as well. So if you'd like to join in again, 800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page. Christine in Woodstock up next. Christine, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi. I hope you can help me. My situation is we, on our land, we have an original garden with the strawberries, raspberries, you know, and some fruit trees. And I've kept up the garden, you know, of course, adding tomatoes and normal vegetables. But my raspberries look great in the spring. They have flowers. They start to have the fruit, and then they peter. You know, the fruits almost shrivel like raisins, and they turn black. And that's it. So they never quite get to the point where they're a true large raspberry. So I don't know if the cane, if I need to get the raspberry plants, if they're too old, if there's something that's sucking the life out of the fruit. But they get to a certain stage, and then the fruit just never make it.
Okay.
Yeah, unfortunately, raspberries and strawberries and those other kinds of fruits are not my area of expertise. And that doesn't happen to, your question doesn't happen to hit on anything I kind of know in my back pocket. So I have no idea what that could be. And I would recommend that you call one of the master gardeners, call the master gardener helpline. Those folks have really been trained in that sort of thing. And I'm sure someone there would be able to identify the source.
Yeah, I'm not... It's a hard one to come up with. And, of course, if you call your Dane County or your extension office, your county extension office, there will be likely either an extension horticulturist there or a master gardener that can help with that particular question. I'm sorry, not sure. That's not a question that I can remember getting over time that I would even have a way to answer myself. Good luck, Christine. Thanks for calling. Maybe somebody else has an idea about it, too, and can call in with a suggestion. Love to hear that as well at 800-642-1234. So, Christine, stay listening. Joe in Token Creek, let's go to you now. Hi, Joe.
Hi, good morning. Good afternoon, yeah. Well, it's good morning. A question about, I see that there are some folks that are going back to heirloom vegetables. And I'm wondering how practical that is for CSAs or for organic gardening.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, heirlooms have been very popular over the last number of years. And part of the reason for that is because they are known generally for improved flavor. So a lot of the hybrids have been hybridized in order to promote their storage capabilities. And heirlooms have not been so treated, and so they are often, you know, popular because of their flavor. They do work well in organic production. There are some protections that growers will put in place to help their heirlooms along sometimes, especially heirloom tomatoes. because the heirloom tomatoes tend to be really prone to cracking and blemishes of other kinds that can make them somewhat unsightly at the farmer's market, unless you happen to have a fondness for the more ugly vegetables, as they're sort of gaining in popularity as well. And certainly once you taste that heirloom tomato, you forgive it its blemishes. So in your own yard, you know, you know exactly what has been done to that plant, and so it's, you know, for me, a lot easier to, like I said, forgive those blemishes of the heirlooms. But some things that you can do to protect them a little bit, what commercial growers are doing often is growing those heirlooms in a hoop house where they're not exposed to rain. And then the heirlooms tend not to have as many blemishes because they're not being hit with those raindrops, and it's harder for disease to spread because a lot of the diseases on tomatoes are coming from the ground through the soil splash that happens during a rain. Another thing you can do if you are not wanting or don't have space for putting in that kind of temporary structure where you can protect your tomato plants, you can also mulch. I use always marsh hay mulch under my tomatoes, and that will help prevent that soil splash, like I said, so the disease won't get up on the plants as much. It's not going to protect the tops of the tomatoes from being hit by that rain, which can also cause cracking. So the short answer to that question is yes, heirlooms definitely work with organic production, and there are some really basic organic techniques that you can use in your garden that will help you be successful with heirlooms and with any other vegetables, whether or not they're from heirloom stock.
Yeah.
Well, thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks very much. I kind of like the Brandywine heirloom. Although you're right, they get huge tomatoes, and they do crack, but they're a beefsteak type tomato, and they taste really good.
And you can always cut off that little blemish whatever in the kitchen. It's not a big deal, especially on a tomato that large.
Yeah, especially. Joe, thanks very much. Let's go to Sue in, I believe, Bennett, Wisconsin. Sue, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi. Yes, we're up here in northwestern Wisconsin, and I'm having trouble with my tomatoes. I have raised beds, and when I first put them in, I gave them good organic potting soil every year. I put in good organic compost to feed them. And the last 2 years, the tomato plants have developed septoria leaf spot. And the other problem I'm having is they're not producing. I'll get blossoms, but then they won't fruit. And then the other problem with the septoria leaf spot, and it's spread to all the tomatoes, including the ones that I have in containers. And so last year what I tried doing is planting fewer plants and trying to create as much aeration as possible, cutting back foliage to try and control the disease and also, you know, promote more growth of fruit as opposed to foliage. But I've been very unsuccessful, and last year I basically had to pull all of the plants because of, you know, the foliage, all the leaves, you know, turned brown and rotted and fell off the plants. And I pulled them off before they would fall into the soil to try and keep them out of the soil. But I'd appreciate any tips you could give me for what I should do next.
Yeah. Do you know what, by the way, just offhand, what varieties of tomatoes you were using?
Many different kinds. Some were heirloom, some were hybrid, some were open pollinated. I try to, you know, have a diverse crop. And there were cherry tomatoes. I tried last year, one of the things I did, because we're so far north here, was to pick varieties that, you know, that would grow in this climate, you know,
maturing. Or...
Yeah, early maturing, not, you know, not big beefsteak tomatoes that require 120 days. And I will say that the last 2 years, our summers have been very poor. They've been cooler, they've been overcast, and they've been kind of wet. So I know that that contributes to the disease and to the lack of production, but, you know, I'm just wondering, maybe I should just stop growing tomatoes up here, or trying to.
Well, you're not the only one in the state to have septoria leaf spot problems, but go ahead, Claire, and comment.
Have you moved the tomatoes? You said you also tried growing them in containers. Are you growing them on fresh soil at
all? No. Well, the ones in the containers are always fresh soil.
Sure.
But the raised beds, the soil what I do is I try to, you know, I add new compost to it every year, but I don't, like, remove the soil from the bed and put in new soil.
So, and you've had tomatoes in those raised beds consistently for how long?
Probably 4 years.
Mm. Yeah. I will sometimes in my garden grow tomatoes for 2 years in the same spot, but I would never go longer than that. I know it's hard in raised beds, or really in any garden that's limited in size, when tomatoes are the crop you really want to have and you've only got a certain amount of space to grow it in. It's hard to rotate your crops around when your space is limited. But I would recommend taking a year or two off of those tomatoes and growing some other vegetable crops in that space, especially crops that are not part of the same family that tomatoes are in, so not solanaceous crops. You can also grow cover crops in that area. That'll help put more nutrients into the soil. I hear that you're putting compost in regularly, and that's great. That's very helpful. You're doing a lot for the soil, and you're adding some other microbes to the soil that way too, to help enhance the biological activity of it. Cover crops are another way to do that same sort of thing. And I think your soil just needs a rest from those tomatoes. And in the meanwhile, I don't know if Larry wants to talk about this or not. I did mention it earlier as well, but he was telling me that he hasn't had any disease problems to speak of in his straw bale technique. So it may be that if you've got, you know, a little space where you can put a few straw bales in, you could give those raised beds a rest and just move your tomatoes to the straw bales.
You know, I was thinking that. And my other question then would be, can you recommend some other vegetable crops or good cover crops?
Yes, absolutely. The vegetable crops would really be just dependent on what you like, what you want to grow in that space. The crops I would recommend not growing in your tomato beds would be peppers, potatoes, an eggplant, because those are all in that same family with tomatoes,
right.
So they're going to be susceptible to the same type of diseases. So if you like spinach and salad mix or lettuces, those are things that you can put in really early in the year, as soon as you can work that soil and get a crop out of it, and then move into either another vegetable crop for fall harvest, like even broccoli or cauliflower or kohlrabi, something like that. You could plant later in the summer for fall harvest. And then if you'd rather, I might start out right away with a cover crop in those beds. And what you can plant first thing in the spring in terms of a cover crop are oats and peas are a great combination. It's really good to combine a legume, which is a pea, and a grass, which is the oats in this case. They work well together, and the peas will grow right up that oat stem and kind of support themselves on those oats. The peas as a legume will be fixing nitrogen in the soil, and that root system works well with the fibrous root system of the oats. Mm-hmm. And they're fairly, if you plant them in the spring, the way to kill them is to, you can cut them down with a saw and kind of work in the root mass that is left, and then plant into that after a few days of letting that decompose. And then when I use that method, I usually take that oat and straw biomass from the above ground growth and just use it, stack it, and use it as mulch elsewhere in the garden. So I'm not losing that biomass. If you don't want to use it as mulch, you can just cut it down or rip it out with your hand and just turn it back into that soil with a shovel, and then give it some time to decompose. And then you should be, you know, as if you're incorporating the whole plant of those oats and peas, you might want to give it a week or two before you plant anything else in there. But those are a great cover crop to go in the spring.
So plant those in the spring, and then in the fall, cut them down, work it into the soil. I probably wouldn't plant anything. We have such a short summer. But then the following year, I could maybe try planting tomatoes there again.
I'm glad you asked that. So with oats and peas, it shouldn't take till fall. You should be able to cut those down and incorporate them. Usually well, I'm further south in Madison, so I'm not sure exactly how this will translate for you, but I am usually able to take them down here at the end of July or even early August. So
you're planting when?
You can plant in the Madison area, you can plant as early as April 15th. So as soon as you can safely work the soil, as soon as it's dried out enough from that winter snow.
Okay.
So basically about 3 months?
Yeah. The way you can tell, the ideal time to take down most any cover crop is when it's in full flower. So you want it to, the oats aren't going to flower so well. They're not going to flower in the way I usually recognize as a flower, even though the oat might consider it a flower. But the peas are really easy to tell because those are going to, you know, look like a flower like you'd normally see. And you want it to be in full flower because that's when the plant is starting to move from its nitrogenous growth stage into more of a carbonaceous stage. And so if you take it down at that time, you're capturing the most nitrogen in your soil to be used by the next crop that you plant. And you don't want to let it go too far into its flowering, because then you'll start to form seeds, and potentially those seeds, if they mature on that plant, can become a weed in the future. Now, a pea weed is not, you know,
not
hardly worth calling a weed, exactly. So you're not in a big risk there. But like I said, ideally take it down when it first starts to flower, and I think Larry's right, about 3 months.
Okay.
And then you can go in to, I love talking about cover crops. Can you tell?
Yeah.
I just have one more thing to say about cover crops.
Well, I'm glad you are, because I was thinking about that. You know, I was kind of figuring that the beds needed a rest and I could do a cover crop or try growing something else there. So, you know, that's really been very helpful.
Great.
And you wanted to add something, though, on cover.
Yeah, I can. When you take those oats and peas down, or whatever type of cover crop that someone might plant in the spring, you can, like I said, go into a fall vegetable crop at that time. I mentioned a few. I would add to that spinach or salad mix or lettuce. All those things will work in the fall as well. Or you can plant another cover crop. So if you want to give those beds a full year's worth of rest, then you can go into my current favorite for a fall cover crop that will survive the winter and last into spring is vetch, hairy vetch. Because it is another legume, it will germinate pretty readily and grow pretty easily, and it is so easy to kill in the spring. A very popular combination on vegetable farms are to grow vetch, hairy vetch, with rye. And I've done that, and I've, you know, as a farmer, I did that for many years. At the time, I had a tractor and a rototiller that I could use to work in that rye and vetch, and that was wonderful. It worked well. But on the garden scale, I found that working rye in by hand with a shovel is, or even with a walk-behind rototiller, is a lot of work. And so I tend to focus on oats as that grass that I'm growing instead of the rye. I've taken rye off of my garden scale list. But the vetch does really well. And in the spring, it's, you know, you can let it grow through May, often is when I'll take my vetch down. So right when you're about ready to plant those tomatoes again, late May, you'll just be able to rip that vetch right off of the top of the soil. You can work it in, like I mentioned with the oats and the peas, or you can roll it up. I will sometimes, you know, let it dry out on the bed and roll it up and then plant my tomatoes or whatever crop is going in, and then position that vetch around those plants again. It's not going to be much of a mulch. It's very thin and it's going to decompose pretty regularly, but there's a fair bit of nitrogen in that vetch. And so when you put it back around those plants, that'll go into the soil as a nutrient to help them grow through the season.
Yeah, there we go.
Okay. Well, thank you very much for your time. We'll let you move on to somebody else.
Thank you, Sue. Let's move on to somebody else. Tom in Milwaukee up next. Tom, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hello, and we're so thankful for your show.
Thank you.
I'm calling today about tomato grafting. I don't know if your guest is knowledgeable about that, but I'm looking for information she can impart.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not super knowledgeable about it. I have read about it and been to some sessions to learn about it. I've never actually done it myself. And the farmers that I work with in the area for this, in preparation for this organic vegetable production conference that I mentioned, I asked a question. We will have a session on tomatoes, and I asked the growers who will be presenting in that session if they're doing any grafting, and all three of them said no, and that some of them had tried it and looked into it, but didn't feel it was worth the time. So the way that it works is that you purchase seed for rootstock, and the idea is that rootstock has it has some strengths that a typical tomato, especially an heirloom tomato, might not have as it grows up. And so we're looking for disease resistance and a certain level of robustness. And then what you grow out that rootstock, and then you cut it off. You grow out the rootstock and the scion, the top part of the plant at the same time. You plant all those seeds at the same time. And then you cut that rootstock off and put the tomato variety that you actually want to have onto it. Often it's cut at an angle, and then you purchase a clip. There's a couple different kinds of clips you can purchase that go around that graft to hold the root part of the plant together with the top part of the plant, and then as they are together in a dark, moist environment, that wound will heal and the plant will start to grow. So that stage right after the grafting is really sensitive. You want to like I said, make sure to protect that plant from light and keep it very moist, because that top part of the plant doesn't have good vascular connection, obviously, to the root where the water is coming from. So you want to keep it pretty moist in there. And a lot of things can go wrong in that environment, right? Because, you know, you can get disease and the plant can die if it doesn't, if you're not super skilled at the graft. So That's the basic about how it works. The reason you would use it, like I said, is for so that plant would be more vigorous and robust and a little bit more able to fend off diseases. It sounds really fun, and I think on a garden scale, it would be really fun to kind of test out and see, especially if you're only doing, you know, a few plants at a time, and your risk is pretty low like I said, with that. That said, I was very interested to learn that the commercial growers are not using it very much. So I think grafting is an indetermined future still.
All right. Thanks, Tom.
The thing I wanted to ask, too, is I see it offered in catalogs, and I guess you could skip some of the steps. You could order it through the catalog. I know Young's and Randolph sells it, and I guess that would probably be the route I would do.
Yeah,
I think one of the things that I learned as a vegetable farmer that I think is very, very applicable to garden scale work is the need for really excellent record keeping. So because if you do that, if you purchase those plants that have already been grafted, which seems like a great way to go, then you would also want to plant some of that same variety that was not grafted and grow those up in a very similar environment, so that you can really note how they do compared to each other. So is it worth the extra cost for that grafted plant versus growing the regular plant on your own? And they're really simple record keeping techniques. I keep a map of my garden so that I know where all the different varieties are, because I grow a bunch of different tomato varieties, as a lot of people do. And I've actually never used the stake in the ground, because as a farmer, that's never going to work very well, right? Those stakes get lost and rained on or trampled or whatever. They disappear. And so I keep a map of where all that stuff is, because that's not going to disappear in the garden. And right on that map that you've made of your tomato bed, it's super easy to bring that out as you're harvesting or weeding or just taking a walk in the garden, whatever, and just jot down your observations with a little date by those notes, so that in the spring, or the winter rather, when you're getting ready to order those tomatoes again, you can look through those notes that you kept and you'll be able to make really informed decisions about your particular situation in your garden.
Yeah, it's a great idea.
Oh, gosh, thanks so much.
Yeah, thank you, Tom, for calling. Appreciate your call. Visiting today with Claire Strader, small-scale and organic produce educator with Dane County UW Extension and Fair Share CSA Coalition. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk here on the Ideas Network. Great to have you with us here on the Ideas Network for this edition of Garden Talk. I'm Larry Mueller, taking a look at organic vegetable gardening today with Claire Strader and with Dane County UW Extension and Fair Share CSA Coalition. Great to have her along. Thank you for listening in. Questions, call in at 800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page. Chris in Monroe has something for us. Hi, Chris.
Hi. About the fellow that was asking about grafted tomatoes, I wanted to say that I took a webinar. It was through eOrganic, and it's available online. It's free. And you could just look in the archives, you know, if you look up the web page for eOrganic, they've done some wonderful webinars, you know, like growing ancient grains and different things. And so I would tell people to look for that. And then Practical Farmers of Iowa has webinars in their on their website that are free. And a third source that I think is really fantastic is if you look up Minnesota Green Book, and that's the Sustainable Agriculture Green Book. And what they do is they give farmers grants, kind of like FAIR, and the farmers can test something, you know, like maybe test high tunnels on raspberries in the northern counties and see how it works out. And they'll do it for a couple of years, and then each year in the Green Book they'll tell you the results. So
lots of good suggestions there.
Yeah, great program. Thank you so much, Claire and Larry.
Thank you, Chris. Appreciate your call. And I imagine, Claire, you'd be in good agreement with Chris on that.
Yeah, there's lots of webinars and YouTube videos on all sorts of things related to organic agriculture, and they've been really helpful, I think, as well.
Let's go to Travis in Menominee next. Travis, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi. I was wondering if you had any ideas or solutions to corn seed maggots in organic production.
Corn seed maggots.
That's a great question, Travis. And isn't that what people always say when they don't know the answer? my only corn seed maggots, yeah, it's not... I don't know. Corn has not been one of the crops that I focused on, because in the vegetable garden it takes up an enormous amount of space, and it's not something I've given over any of my land to.
So maybe somebody else has some ideas on that one. So stay listening, Travis. How big is your garden, by the way, your home garden?
My garden is, I brought my little map, but I don't remember. Well, I can give you the square footage. In the front yard, it's 1,700 square feet, and then in the back, I have another 500 square feet or so. So it's
a pretty good-sized garden there.
Yeah, my partner gets a little bit frustrated with me, because as a history as a vegetable grower, I always I never wanted to purchase food that I wasn't able to grow, and so. We do have exceptions to that now that I am a gardener and not a farmer any longer. But we do still try to grow pretty much all the vegetables that we eat in our own yard. And we've got fruit trees in the back and raspberries and things like that. I just, I'm not as skilled in those fruit crops as I am in the vegetables.
Let's go to Natalie next in Watertown. Natalie, hello. Thank you for calling.
Hi. Hey, I have a question with composting. I have a lot of eggshells, fruit and vegetable peelings, and coffee grounds, and I've heard all of those things are good for your soil, but how to get them into the soil in these, like, during the winter months, I'm not really certain because of the frozen ground. And in the summer months, when you have your plants growing, you don't really want to disturb the root system. So to turn them in, it seems like only when right before you're going to rototill, but then you know, the rest of the year when you have coffee and eggshells and banana peels, if I just throw them out on top of the garden, I wind up with critters.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, so, certainly. Do you have ideas?
Have you done a compost pile yet? That might be...
No, my neighbor did not want me to do that. He said that it just smells and attracts mice and critters.
Well, yeah. If you do it right, it doesn't necessarily.
Yeah. You can get...
What is the right way?
You can get bins that will help with that, because you know you're not the only person and your neighbor's not the only person who has issues with attracting rodents or other critters you don't want to have around that compost pile. But you can get bins that are made of plastic that will, as long as they're in good shape, should prevent critters from getting in there. And then you can also have compost bins. I just saw some at my friend's house in Minneapolis. I was really interested to see her compost bins. She purchased them from a local supplier who was making them, and they're just made out of wood, and then they're covered with hardware cloth of a very small, the squares are quite small in the hardware cloth so that rodents can't get in there, and then there's a lid on it as well, and that hardware cloth allows the air to come in so that it makes it easier for the things that you put in there to compost. So I would look into those kinds of contained solutions if you want to have a compost pile, which is a really great idea. One other thing you could try, which is not going to help you in the winter, just like you said, is to I've on occasion, when I've had a bed that I'm not growing anything in and that I wanted to be fallow, I've dug a trench in it and buried things in that soil so that the soil can decompose it and it can be covered. And that has worked for me somewhat. I did actually run into some problems with it too, though, because then all the seeds from my squash plant or whatever were all germinating in there too.
Right.
But yeah, I wouldn't do that if you have an actual crop growing in that bed, because just like you said, you're going to damage those roots that way. So I would really look into a compost bin.
I would too. There are some good ones out there, and I some municipalities, and I'm not sure if Watertown does or not, but Madison in the spring often offers for residents. You can purchase them at a decent cost, and they're black usually, because that absorbs the heat and makes the breakdown of the materials faster. And I'd look into that, because you just I've had them and I just haven't had a problem with odor with those.
Oh, you haven't?
No.
So can you put them, like, in the winter months, like by a side door and just, like, chuck out little buckets or bowls of scraps?
Sure, you could, or have them someplace convenient in your backyard area where you might have to, you know, shovel a little snow out of the way to get to it, in a minute or two, just run out there. I've done that many times where I didn't bother to put a coat on or anything else. I just ran out there and dumped it in and ran back in the house.
Right. Can you do that with houseplants? What is the other thing that I've wondered with, like, coffee grounds or eggshells or apple peelings, to just, like, tuck them down in the soil? Or is that not recommended? Does that bring, like, root rot or bugs into your houseplants?
I am not a houseplant expert. I don't tend to do very well with plants in the house, but I would see that going badly to have that wet organic matter, because that potting soil is, like I said earlier, it's a really confined space, and so you're asking a lot of that plant and that soil and that confined space to be able to digest that.
So when, like right now, about a half hour ago, I was looking at some of my house plants and trimmed off the dead stuff, and some of them need like enrichment in their soil. Can you do the same thing like with your, like what you're doing with the garden?
Doesn't work very well.
Yeah, it doesn't. Just buy potting soil.
Yeah, that's what I do, as a matter of fact. But that composting is a great idea, although there are some things like banana peels, for example, may, depending if they're organic or not, it's possible the peels could contain some chemicals, which means that if they're not completely broken down in the compost bin over time, I suppose there could be some problem, although I never hesitated to throw banana peels into one. I've heard people say that, but it isn't something that I actually practiced, but I throw it out there because others have mentioned that to me.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Thank you.
Thanks very much for calling. Appreciate your call. And boy, that composting is such value it provides to your lawn. And we've had questions about all the fertility in my garden, or there's too much clay and things of that nature, and how do I improve the soil? Well, if you can be adding that compost every year or every so often to your soil, it certainly helps take care of that issue. Claire Strader, our guest today, small scale and organic produce educator with Dane County UW Extension and Fair Share CSA Coalition, here on Garden Talk. Great to have you with us for this edition of Garden Talk, visiting about organic vegetable gardening. Today I'm Larry Mealer with my guest Claire Strader, who is a small-scale and organic produce educator with Dane County UW Extension and Fair Share CSA Coalition. Questions about growing organically with vegetables? I hope you'll join in. Number to call, 800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page. And Barry, who's on I-94, has a question for you. So let's go there. Hi, Barry.
Hi, how are you guys?
Great, appreciate the call. You have a suggestion or a solution?
Yeah, I did, for the listener who was struggling with her raspberries. A couple of quick things. The first thing she should try and do every spring is fertilize around the base of her raspberry bushes with composted manure, because they're kind of a hungry plant and they like to feed. Please use composted manure, because if you use the fresh raw stuff, it'll burn the plants and you'll kill them. Second of all, I don't know if she's ever pruned her raspberries plants or how old they are, but they benefit from a pruning every fall after a hard frost. If you've never pruned them, they're spending all that time and energy trying to push out energy into the very furthest, you know, the subsidiary branches, and it's just too much for them to try and fulfill the fruit obligation. So if she can trim them back, if she's never done it before, cut them back by half this coming autumn, and then every fall after that, she can maybe cut them back by a quarter to a third, just give them a little haircut so they can kind of refresh themselves. And if none of that works, then she might possibly have a virus in her soil. So I hope she's listening and can take some of these tips to heart.
Oh, Barry, those are great tips. Thank you so much for calling.
Great, thank you. Sure. Thank you.
Yeah, appreciate it very much. That's one of the things about Garden Talk. There's almost, if you can't come up with an answer, there's almost always somebody listening who has a good suggestion. I know we have a lot of master gardeners who listen to the show,
yeah.
So I lean on them quite a bit. Sue in Stevens Point, it's your turn. Hi, Sue.
Hi. I just had two suggestions for the lady that was just on asking about winter composting.
Yeah.
And I have not done either of these because I just run out to my compost bin and throw stuff in all winter. But One would be an indoor vermiculture bin with worms.
Mm-hmm.
The other would be the bokashi method, which I have not done, but it's you can actually it's you're basically filling a container, and it, they have this bran that they sell that you sprinkle in, and you can actually put in fruit, I mean, vegetable matter, everything, dairy, meat, grains. It basically ferments it. You seal it up, and then it ferments it, and it's all an indoor process. Hmm. And you can buy kits for it. You can make your own. There's all sorts of stuff on the web.
And what's it called again?
Bokashi, B-O-K-A-S-H-I.
Bokashi.
Yeah.
And I so don't you know can, that.
Yeah, it's. I have not tried it. I'm kind of intrigued, but the nice thing about it is that it's indoors, it's sealed, and you can put everything in there. You don't have to worry about it being meat or grain or whatever. Mm-hmm. So it's pretty much every kind of waste.
Oh, well, that's... And to look into that.
Yeah, it's an interesting thing. It's a fermentation process, and then you can just sprinkle that outside, and it's not going to attract critters or anything because it's gone through the whole process of breaking down.
Oh. So, well, Sue, thank you.
You're welcome.
That was really...
Hope that helps.
Yeah, I appreciate that very much. Something that I didn't know anything... Claire, I don't know if you were familiar with.
No, I have not heard of that.
Yeah, really cool. Undine in Marshfield, let's go to you next. Hi, thank you for calling.
Hi, thanks so much. I have a comment about a previous caller just before the news break who was composting during the wintertime, gathering her compost items. I found that if you set aside a dedicated blender, pick up an inexpensive blender to use for this, daily you blend your apple peelings, potato peelings, whatever, you don't have to with your coffee grounds, you blend them up into a slurry. Then in the winter months, you know, it's cold, you get a 5-gallon bucket with a lid, and you deposit your slurry in there, you put it in the garage in a cold spot or outside in a particular spot where it can freeze up. And come the springtime, kind of pay attention, you know, it gets warmer a little bit, the snow recedes, you can see where your plants are if you have a permanent garden or kind of have an idea where your vegetable garden. You just spread that slurry out, rake aside your little bit of mulch you might have, and you spread that out. It's liquid, it's slurried, cover it up with your compost, and you're good to go.
Yeah. Now, there's another one.
Not so good if you have a family of 5 or 6. You know, if there's 2 or 3 people, you can do it. If you don't want to add, you know, bananas, skins, because, you know, mainly they're not so organic, you know, and leave them out.
Yeah.
But that works, that you can, you know, day by day you keep at it, and maybe you keep a container inside the house that through the meals you add to it, then once a day you dump that, and, you know, if you need more buckets, you buy more buckets, but it's all ready to go. It breaks down so quick in the spring, you know, of course, and there's nothing really solid for anything to be milling through very much. And it's a way to, you know, keep composting, but kind of doing it on a simple... And yeah, it's all chopped up. It just incorporates into the garden beautifully.
Oh,
well. So I hope that helps everybody that might be thinking about that, but, you know, you don't want that big clump of something there, you know, to deal with in the springtime.
Well,
we all know how that goes.
Thank you very much. That's another idea that I hadn't thought of or heard of. And, Claire, it sounds like another good tip.
Yeah, sounds like a lot of work.
A little bit of work.
Well, thanks so much.
Yeah, thanks so much for calling. We have many emails. I want to get through a few of those. You can join in, by the way, by phone at 800-642-1234. Give a call. Jim in Delafield emailed to say he just bought a new home. There's a garden space, but he thinks chemicals were used. What can he do to turn it organic?
So the standard for organic certification is that any ground that has had prohibited products or chemicals used on it has to be, cannot be considered certified organic until it's been through 3 years since the last application of the prohibited product. Now, on your garden scale, you're not going to be certified organic, and so it's that three-year minimum is just a, I just throw that out there as something that the certifiers are using as a way to take a look at that ground. If you don't want to eat food off of that ground for those 3 years while the soil works through those prior applications, a great thing to do would be to grow cover crops. And those cover crops can add to your soil fertility, they can improve your soil structure, and they can attract beneficial insects to the property as well at the same time. So and kill weeds. That was the one I was trying to get to. Depending on how many weeds you have in that plot, successions of various cover crops can really help to keep those weeds at bay, and even start to kill off the rhizomatous weeds that you'll get through, like quack grass or thistle even, that sort of thing. And the types of cover crops that you'll use are really dependent on not only the season, the time of year. Different cover crops like to grow in different temperatures and under different conditions, obviously, just like various vegetables. But it will also depend on what your real goals are in that garden. If you just want to have it go through 3 years and not, you know, you don't have other problems there, then it's a great idea to just plant a clover and let that go for 3 years. You would just have to mow it regularly. A Dutch white clover or a medium red clover are the two that I've used most commonly. But if you want to be more actively engaged in that plot or have some weed issues that you really want to start going after, then I would recommend some other cover crops like sorghum Sudan grass and that sort of thing. The sorghum Sudan grass is not going to stay in that plot for 3 years. It's an annual, so it will die over the winter. But it's a very tall, aggressive, corn-like plant that does a lot to smother out weeds in that vicinity. So I would use cover crops.
And you know, you can also say, well, I want to be organic eventually. You could start.
Oh yeah, grow. Yeah.
Grow something right away.
Absolutely.
And just use organic
methods.
Principles.
Yep.
And in 3 years, you can say that, all right, now I could be certified.
That's right.
There you go. Tom in Barnum, Minnesota, emailed to ask, what are the keys to success in growing organic potatoes for the fresh market profitably? Some growers have difficulty with potatoes.
Yeah, I think some growers definitely have difficulty with growing potatoes profitably for the fresh market. And I know a number of CSA growers who have decided that even though they need and want to have potatoes in their CSA shares, that they're not going to grow them themselves on their farms, but rather they're going to contract with another nearby organic grower to provide potatoes for those CSA shares. I don't have a trick for how to grow them profitably, but scale, I think, is really important for potatoes when you're trying to sell them, because the methods that are used on the really small scale and like the same methods I used at the farm are the ones I use in my own garden now, and it's a lot of hand labor. So digging those trenches to plant them in, digging them up by hand, all of that takes a lot of time and labor. But if you can transfer those jobs to tractors instead, or a person obviously running that tractor, especially mechanical harvesting, that can save a lot of time and thus money. And that's gonna help make that potato crop more profitable when you're selling it to the fresh market.
Let's take another email, this one from Lisa, wondering how to loosen up her compacted garden soil.
Well, I have a few thoughts on this question. So there's always cover crops, which I'll spare you more discussion about cover crops, but know that that is one of the first places I would go to loosen garden soil, especially those deep-rooted cover crops can do a lot to break up compaction in the soil. Another thing that I would go to right away is to start thinking about doing less tillage in the garden. often people will use a rototiller to go through and prepare the garden for planting in the spring. And that can be doing some real damage to that soil and also to the critters that live in that soil. Like worms can be broken up when they're, cut in half when they're rototilled. And those two ends of that worm are not going to live. They're both going to die. And so you're decreasing that population of worms in the garden when you're rototilling. The other thing that you're doing when you're rototilling is creating this thing called a plow pan. So as those tines spin in the soil, they're hitting at the same depth typically over and over again, and they're pounding the soil right under, right where the bottom of that tiller blade is hitting, causing compaction. And so even though the top part, after you rototill is really nice and light and fluffy and really great to plant into, when the plant grows, the roots will hit that plow pan, and it can be really difficult for them to penetrate it. So the solution to that is to not rototill anymore and to move to no-till techniques, which is what I've done in my own garden. The first thing, my garden was lawn before it was garden, and I did rototill it, and I spent a whole summer growing cover crops on that lawn to kill the grass and improve the soil. And I used a rototiller to do that because working cover crops by hand can be very difficult. But after that last cover crop was killed, my garden has never seen a rototiller again since. So I dug permanent beds and permanent paths so that my footsteps are always compacting the path, and I never step in my garden bed ever, because the weight of my body or anybody else's body who's stepping in that bed is compacting that soil. And then the things that I do to prep those beds are to, take down any cover crops by hand, and then I'll gently loosen that soil with a fork or a shovel and plant into it. So all that soil underneath have, the roots of those cover crops that I still grow in my beds are penetrating that soil, creating channels for water and worms and roots to go down. Because when I kill that cover crop, it leaves the channel that root grew in is still going to be there when that root decomposes, and it makes a pathway for the roots of my vegetable crops. So then I just will work the soil a little bit at the top if I need to plant seeds. Sometimes when I'm transplanting, I won't work the soil at all. I'll just dig a little hole and pop that transplant in, and the roots of that plant will be able to go through those channels that were created by the previous plants that were there. So quick to just wrap up that long answer, I would say think about cover crops. They can be really beneficial, especially the ones that are deep-rooted, to break up that compaction. And then also think about, I don't know whether you're rototilling or not, but I would really think about giving that up if you are, and just using permanent beds and paths and mulches to help keep your soil in good shape.
That was a very good answer, and I think one that a lot of people... Or we're probably taking some notes, at least mental notes, on as you talked about it. Very good. Anita, in Gurnee, Illinois, your turn. Hi, Anita.
Hi. We are avid gardeners, and we have a big raised bed garden. And we're going to be going away for all of the growing season this year. Yeah. And so there's not going to be any tending of the garden, but I don't want to leave it blank because we'll come back, it'll be nothing but one big weed. So we're wondering if there's something we can plant that is like a good cover crop that will, keep a lot of the weeds out.
Absolutely. Of course there is. Yeah, this is my favorite question all day. So, because it's super straightforward. So what I would plant is a combination of Dutch white clover and probably something like oats, because the oats will be a nurse crop for that clover, which means that they'll come up and keep the soil covered a little bit while that clover gets a chance to germinate. The clover is going to take a little longer to germinate. And then if you can do that right away in the spring. As soon as you can work the soil, you can plant your oats and clover. And then if you, and by right away in the spring, like I said earlier, in the Madison area, that's around April 15th. And then let that grow up. The oats, you know, if you have a chance to take those down with a sickle or some kind of knife or a lawnmower, if it's a flat surface. You're in a raised bed, so a lawnmower probably won't work. So you can just use a knife or a sickle to take those oats down, and then that clover will just be there for the rest of the year and into the next if you want it to be.
Yeah, perfect.
What kind of clover was that again?
Dutch white is the one that I use a lot, but you can also use medium red clover. And then another thing you can do, which is not a cover crop, so a little bit different answer this time, is you can simply just take a really thick layer of marsh hay or straw. I would recommend marsh hay, actually, in this situation, and cover that bed with a nice thick mat of that mulch, and it should prevent weeds as well. And then that'll decompose a little bit over the course of the year, and it'll be great for planting into next year.
And then may I ask if the white clover and the oats, am I growing them from seed, or am I buying bedding plants?
No, you'll grow those from seed. And usually garden centers are carrying some cover crop mixes more. So you can go to Jung's, for instance, and buy Dutch white or medium red clover and oats. And then there'll be a planting rate on that bag, and you'll just scatter it over the soil, and then you should really cover it. So you can rake it in, but I prefer to actually use a fork or a shovel and incorporate it in that top inch of soil, because if you just leave it on top, it's not going to germinate very well. You really want to work it into that top inch of soil and water it. Then water it.
Okay, and then when we come back, and it's not going to be any type of perennial, right? We'll be able to get it out so we can have crops next year.
It is. The clover will still be there, and you'll just have to use a fork and turn that over and kill it. If you want something that's going to die, then I would wait a little bit later into the year, and once the weather has evened out, and put in a sorghum Sudan grass or something like that will winter kill. And then you'll just have a layer of mulch on top.
Okay. Okay, thank you.
All right. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Karen emailed to say she used old railroad ties about 9 years ago for a terrace garden. Should she have her soil tested for arsenic? And she had a question about grow lights as well. Best ones.
Yeah, I don't know enough about old railroad ties except to know that there's a possibility that there could be some contaminants in there. So I don't know that arsenic is the one. I would look online for what the potential contaminant could be. But yeah, I would be thinking about getting that soil tested and maybe growing ornamentals in those beds instead of food crops.
And you could, again, when you go to the soil and plant analysis laboratories, you can specify that this area had these old railroad ties, and they'll know what to test for.
Yeah, that's great. In terms of grow lights, I know there's sometimes a lot of talk about that, and people will buy those full spectrum lights to start their plants under. I have to say that I have never done that. I just use straight up fluorescent lights. Although this last year, I had to replace some of the bulbs that I used to start seedlings in my basement, and I switched to the LED lights. And I don't know. I guess I have never used the full spectrum light, so I don't know that if my plants would be much better if I did use them. But I've had no trouble with your standard fluorescent bulb, and my seedlings have been very adequate, very good.
I have some LED lights for Limey.
Oh yeah.
just in a lamp, a pole lamp, and a position pretty close, and Limey seems to like them.
Yeah.
So, oh, my goodness me. Well, you know, the old clock on the wall says things are winding up here. Claire, thank you so much. This was a lot of fun. I hope we have a chance to do this again.
Yeah, I hope so, too.
Claire Strader, our guest today, small-scale and organic produce educator with the Dane County UW Extension and the Fair Share CSA Coalition. We'll get her back and we'll do this again. Great to have you listening in next Friday on Garden Talk. Brian Huddleston, Dr. Death, will be back to help you with your plant disease. problems, and I'm sure we'll be talking about Garden Expo, because he and I will be speaking with Lisa Johnson at Garden Expo on February 10th, about 9 in the morning or so. In the meantime, thanks for listening. Stay with us. Lots in store.